Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Sunday, the 15th of March. Our main stories. In an effort to combat the spread of the coronavirus, Spain and France introduced partial lockdowns. The US extends its ban on travel from Europe for non-American citizens.
The president has made a decision to suspend all travel to the United Kingdom and Ireland effective midnight Monday night.
And restrictions are coming into force in Israel and some African countries. Also in the podcast. Why music with roots in the 15th century is still relevant in the Balkans today, and how the global film industry is struggling to cope with the fallout from the coronavirus. In a dramatic ramping up of the coronavirus restrictions in place across much of Europe, France and Spain have announced partial lockdowns. We'll hear from Spain in a moment, but the French measures include the closure of cafes, restaurants and all non-essential public places. The French Prime Minister Edouard Philippe said the number of people in intensive care was growing and earlier containment restrictions had been ignored. 91 people have died in France of COVID-19, and there are nearly 4,500 confirmed cases. Our Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield has the details.
This is a dramatic ratcheting up of the French response that reflects growing alarm at the fast spread of the virus. In a televised announcement, Prime Minister Edouard Philippe said it was clear that people were not properly following existing advice on limiting encounters with others.
Jusqu'à nouvel ordre. La fermeture à compter de ce soir minuit.
I have therefore decided on new measures. From midnight, all public places except essential services will be closed. That means cafes, restaurants, cinemas and discos, and all shops except essential services, including food shops, pharmacies and banks, as well as petrol stations. Public transport will remain open, but I ask the public to reduce their movements, particularly between urban areas. I say with great seriousness that we must show more discipline in following these measures.
The one exception to this drastic lockdown are the town hall elections, which take place tomorrow with a second round in a week. But the government had already committed itself to maintaining the elections, despite the concentrations of people that will inevitably ensue.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Speaking shortly after his French counterpart, the Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez announced a 15-day shutdown. People will not be allowed to leave their homes except to buy food or medicine or to go to work. Unlike in France, regional elections are being postponed while some rail services are being reduced. More than 190 people have died in Spain and at least 6,000 been infected, the second highest total in Europe after Italy. So what is the mood like in Spain at the moment? I spoke to our Madrid correspondent, Guy Hedgeco.
It has been quite remarkable how the atmosphere in the city has changed enormously over the last few days. I mean, Madrid is a place that has seen the most drastic measures so far. The fact that restaurants, bars and other public venues have been closed has really changed the way the city feels. I mean, there are a lot of touristy places like the Plaza Mayor, which are normally absolutely packed on a Saturday, for example, which have been pretty much abandoned today. Very quiet. A lot of busier streets or streets which would normally be quite busy have been extremely quiet as well. Spaniards love to go out and to rub shoulders, go to bars and cafes and restaurants. They haven't been able to do any of that, certainly in Madrid today. And as of Monday, they won't be able to do it anywhere across the country, it seems. So it really has changed the atmosphere, at least in the capital.
And are people happy with how the government is handling the situation?
Well, I think opinion is rather divided on this. Most people seem to be obeying the government or the government's suggestions, at the very least, and seems resigned to doing what they're told. But not everyone is obeying. There have been people who haven't been staying at home or who haven't been following the rules of not standing too close to people in the supermarket and all those sort of rules. And there are people who really don't agree with this. They think that it's all over the top. So the Spanish political landscape is very divided. And I think in many ways, the reaction to all of this crisis reflects that division. There are a lot of people who don't trust the government, and I think they're probably not going to trust the government's handling of the coronavirus crisis.
Guy Hedgeko in Madrid. President Trump, meanwhile, has banned all travel to the US from the UK and the Republic of Ireland after the number of fatalities in Britain nearly doubled to 21. The new restrictions will take effect at midnight local time on Monday. People from 26 other European countries are already banned from entering the States. American citizens will be allowed to return home. From Washington, Jane O'Brien reports.
The message from the White House today, America is all but closed. The European travel ban ordered by President Trump on Wednesday has now been extended to the UK and Ireland. The announcement was made by Vice President Mike Pence.
The President has made a decision to suspend all travel to the United Kingdom and Ireland effective midnight Monday night, Eastern Standard Time.
Americans themselves and permanent residents will still be allowed into the country, but they'll be funneled through specific ports of entry and told to self-isolate for 14 days. Mr. Pence also confirmed that the administration is considering domestic travel restrictions as the number of confirmed cases of coronavirus has risen to more than 2,000. President Trump, who has been in contact with people who've tested positive for the virus, said that he had now been tested and was waiting for the results. He said his temperature was normal.
Jane O'Brien in Washington. Restrictions are also coming into force in Africa and across the Middle East, including Israel and Egypt. Our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher told me the latest from his region.
I'm in Iran. Sadly, the death toll has risen again. It's over 600 now. This is the official death toll. I mean, the belief is amongst most people observing what's going on that it's probably a lot higher. And the numbers of those infected, more than 12,000. They have embarked on efforts to clear the streets of people and also large-scale testing. Tens of thousands of people have been tested, is the latest. Officials there, though, are still partly accusing the US of being responsible, but also saying that the sanctions the US brought in have made the situation that much worse. Now, a lot of the other countries in the Middle East that have coronavirus essentially have traced back most of their cases to Iran. And those countries are taking more and more, as you were just saying, efforts to try and close down their borders to try and prevent the spread further. So we have the Saudis, Kuwait and Jordan have all said that they have cancelled or will be within the next couple of days cancelling international flights. In the United Arab Emirates, they've stepped up their efforts. They're shutting down all tourist attractions, including the Louvre. They have a branch there. And also telling hotels that they can't hold weddings. Obviously, that's a huge thing in most countries. Egypt has now closed down schools and universities. So although they haven't yet had any deaths in those areas, they are taking it very, very seriously.
Now, you've been looking in more detail at Yemen and a possible closure of an airport, which is key to getting aid into the country.
Yes. I mean, Yemen, war-torn country, the feeling is that what we've seen, you know, obviously is appalling across the world. But in somewhere like that, where people don't have immune systems after years of war, the health system has been devastated. It could be really, really serious. Now, Sana'a Airport, which is controlled by the Houthi rebels, doesn't have passenger flights, but it does have UN flights. The Houthis have just said that they are closing down the airport. Now, I was speaking earlier to the representative of the WHO in Yemen, Altaf Moussani, and this is what he had to say.
We do look at the fact that if we are humanitarian workers coming in, we've already gone through travel throughout a number of airports and have been screened. And there's a responsibility and onus on us. We've actually sent the messaging to humanitarians. Should you have travel history, should you be not well, self-quarantine and alert. Don't get on that plane.
Strangely enough, the three countries in the Middle East that are the ones have been most hit by horror, by war, by starvation, are the ones that haven't confirmed any cases so far. It's Yemen, Syria, and that's Libya. Now, that may be because they're in such chaos that they haven't had any testing, they haven't been able to get round to it. The Syrians have actually postponed elections that were due to be held. Not that those elections probably would mean very much. Also, schools and universities closed. Libya, haven't heard very much about that, but it's in such chaos. You can understand that when the virus hits, it's really going to hit those countries incredibly hard.
Our Middle East regional editor, Sebastian Usher. Well, so far, Africa seems to have been spared the worst of the outbreak, but now more than 20 countries across the continent have confirmed cases of COVID-19. Among the latest to report their first infections are Namibia and Rwanda. I discussed the outbreak with our Africa editor, Mary Harper, starting with the Rwandan case.
It was a bit surprising that the virus appeared in Rwanda because they've been setting up wash basins with soap, sanitised dispensers throughout the capital, Kigali. It's a very disciplined, authoritarian country, so people really do pay attention to any kind of preventative measures that have been introduced. But what happened was that somebody came from Mumbai, an Indian, a few days ago, and he was the first person to be confirmed to have the virus. He's now in quarantine, and I imagine the Rwandans will be doing their utmost to trace people he's been in contact with and to quarantine them as well.
And what other measures are we seeing across Africa?
Interestingly, we've seen South Africa being the first country in sub-Saharan Africa to repatriate dozens of its citizens who were in Wuhan, which was where the whole problem began. Many African students are in China. Also, people were working there. They're going into quarantine for up to 21 days in South Africa, which also today, Saturday, recorded its highest number of people, new cases, and now they have 38 confirmed cases in South Africa.
And is the African health services across the continent, are they able to cope?
I mean, in some ways, people like to say that there's no way that this impoverished continent is going to be able to cope with coronavirus. But we must remember that Africa does know how to deal with infectious diseases, especially Ebola, which has hit it in recent years pretty hard, very badly in West Africa, and also in an incredibly violent part of Congo in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And they did manage eventually to contain those outbreaks. So maybe Africa is better prepared than people think. And it is interesting that so far, most cases are people coming either as tourists or travellers from abroad or Africans who've been abroad and then are coming back home. But we do have to wait and see. I think the next couple of weeks are going to be very telling for Africa.
Yeah, and briefly surprising, given the huge amount of investment from China, that there haven't been more cases earlier on.
Exactly. It is pretty bizarre. I mean, I was in Addis Ababa airport recently and it was absolutely packed with Chinese because the Chinese are doing all the construction and infrastructure development in Ethiopia. And yet Ethiopia has only recorded one single case of the coronavirus. So it is very interesting that that's how things have panned out so far.
Mary Harper, our Africa editor. As the coronavirus spreads around the world, publishers have been recording huge increases in sales of novels about fictional epidemics. Among them is the 1947 novel The Plague by Nobel Prize-winning French author Albert Camus. This report from Richard Hamilton.
What is more real than death?
From the classic novel by Albert Camus.
A trailer for the 1992 film The Plague, starring William Hurt and Robert Duvall.
You were the first to suggest isolation.
No doctor can cure it.
Camus' novel is set in the Algerian town of Oran, which becomes quarantined from the rest of the world as a mysterious illness kills off one innocent inhabitant after another. The book is loosely based on a cholera epidemic that erupted in Iran in 1849, but it's also an allegory for the Nazi occupation of France. Sales of The Plague have tripled in Italy, putting it in the country's top 10 bestsellers. And sales have also risen in France, where 1,600 copies were sold in the last week of January, an increase of 300%. Here in the UK, its publishers Penguin are rushing through a reprint of their English translation after stocks ran out. At the moment, the paperback is 47th on the Amazon bestsellers ranking. The editorial director of Penguin Classics, Jess Harrison, said the book could not be more relevant to the current moment. Other novels enjoying a revival include The Stand by Stephen King and Eyes of Darkness by Dean Koontz, both published in the United States more than 30 years ago. The Stand is a post-apocalyptic science fiction story about the accidental release of a strain of flu, modified for biological warfare, which ends up killing 99% of the world's population. And The Eyes of Darkness is about a fictional virus called Wuhan 400. Sales of the ebook increased by 3,000%, and it's now ranked second on Amazon UK's Kindle store after a tweet about Koontz having predicted coronavirus went viral. With thousands around the world expected to endure weeks of self-isolation, what better time to read novels about pestilence, plagues and pandemics?
Richard Hamilton. And still to come on the podcast, after the recent intercommunal violence in India, what does the future hold for this once famously secular nation? We'll have more on the coronavirus a little later in the podcast, but let's look at some other news stories now. And the release of Taliban prisoners from Afghan jails, agreed as part of the US-Taliban peace deal, is now on hold. The Taliban say 5,000 of their supporters should be released before the start of any talks with an Afghan delegation. With more details, here's our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan.
An Afghan government spokesman said the authorities would not release anyone without a guarantee that freed militants would not take up guns again. Earlier this week, President Ashraf Ghani agreed to release about 1,500 Taliban prisoners in the first phase and laid out conditions for granting further amnesties. The government insists that attacks on Afghan troops should subside. The Taliban are refusing to accept a phased and conditional release of prisoners. The US, which negotiated a deal with the Taliban to withdraw its troops from Afghanistan, has been talking to both sides to break the deadlock.
Anbarasan Etirajan. More than 50 people are now known to have been killed in riots last month in the Indian capital, Delhi. Hindus and the minority Muslim community blame each other for the bloodshed, but a majority of those killed were Muslims. Tensions had been rising for months. Our correspondent in Delhi, Richard Galpin, has been assessing whether India's status as a secular state is now in jeopardy.
Last month's violence here in Delhi, which largely targeted the Muslims, but also left Hindus dead, was a profound trauma and something not witnessed in India for decades. In one of the worst hit areas, I met Gufran Beg and Afsana, who've returned to their home briefly to collect belongings. They'd been lucky to emerge unscathed from the violence, as Afsana told me.
A mob came to our house, threatened us and hurled abuse. They wanted to scare us so we would leave. They tried to break down the doors. We feared for the safety of our young daughters.
Gufran blames the government for the violence.
The government just wants to drive the Muslims out. They want only the Hindus to stay here. No other religion. We want Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs and Christians to all live like brothers. But the government wants everyone to be divided.
The atmosphere is becoming increasingly toxic for the Muslim community, with government ministers and other officials openly speaking about them in ways which people say amount to hate speech. This was the Deputy Finance Minister, Anurag Thakur, speaking in January.
What should be done to the traitors?
Shoot the traitors, chants the crowd. There are also reports social media is being used extensively by government supporters to put out messages suggesting Muslims are a threat. The governing party, the BJP, denies it's deliberately marginalising the Muslims. Dilip Ghosh is the party leader in West Bengal.
BJP is a political party.
The BJP is a political party and does politics based on the constitution of India. Nothing more, nothing less. The BJP works on the basis of democracy and secularism.
And yet, this is Dilip Ghosh speaking at a rally in January, saying they're going to identify 5 million illegal Muslim immigrants in Bengal and, if necessary, throw them out of the country. Muslims are also dismayed by policies which the government has been implementing, which they say discriminate against them on the basis of their religion. And that's prompted an unprecedented response. Muslim women and men, for the first time, staging protests like this one here in Delhi, demanding the government scraps the policies. Aliya is a 14-year-old student and protester.
They don't want us, so that is why we are here to take our rights, and we are Indians and we cannot leave this place. We will be here till the government withdraws these laws.
The fact that Muslims here have been staging peaceful protests against government policies which they say discriminate against the Muslim community is a significant moment, and one which poses a serious challenge to the government of Narendra Modi.
A call by a local BJP leader to shut down one of these protests is what many believe sparked the recent violence. The political commentator Shiv Vishwanathan believes the BJP government is using violence for its own benefit, something he claims it's done in the past.
This has been the agenda of the regime. Violence becomes an act of legitimation. Violence is normalized, and violence is used against minorities and marginals to consolidate majoritarian rule.
Last month's violence forced hundreds of Muslims who've lost everything to live in makeshift camps. Inside one of these, a forlorn place, I met Asma.
You tell me, can you see any future for us? We don't even know what our future is. So how can we envision one for our kids? You never know when a riot will start again.
This is a delicate moment in India's history. The Muslim and Hindu communities are becoming increasingly divided under the current government, which could have enormous repercussions for what's supposed to be a secular nation.
Richard Galpin reporting. Now to a song about love and longing for the snowy mountains of Bosnia.
Oy, Bosanske. Gore snježene, sevdalinko, puna čežnje.
Now that is a Sevda song, or Sevdalinka, revered across the Balkans. Its origins can be traced back to the 15th century, but it evolved in the 19th century in the cafes of Sarajevo and Mostar in Bosnia. It has remained popular ever since, surviving empires, communism and wars. The singer is Damir Imamović, known across the Balkans as the King of Sevda. His latest album has just been released. He spoke to my colleague Alex Ritson from Sarajevo.
Well, Sevda music is the music that comes from what used to be a border between European and Eastern Ottoman world. And it's a kind of a mixture of different things of the heritage of Ottoman Turks, combination of that music towards the end of the 19th century with European trends, with Austrian music. And as you mentioned, during communism, we had a really prolific generation for this music, many interesting and important music stars in former Yugoslavia who played this music. And it even used to be a kind of a pop music during the 50s and 60s. So what we have today is a sevdah. Sevdah in Turkish means love. And that by no means, that doesn't mean that this music is sung in Turkish. It's sung in this local vernacular called Bosnian or Serbian Croatian. And but it still remains the music of the border between two worlds. So you can hear many things in it coming from both east and west.
Yeah, so it starts in Bosnia, but a much wider appeal right across the Balkans.
Yeah, of course, we mostly speak the same language all around former Yugoslavia, or at least we can understand it. So it's a kind of a common heritage. And Sevda had different phases. Even earlier in history, the very word Sevda comes from actually Arab and Turkish, but it has this beautiful connection with the ancient Greek world, where this famous medicine man Galen thought that melancholos, or the black bile, this humor that existed in the human body, could be used to treat the disease, you know, and that's why we have melancholy today. My grandfather, who used to be a huge star of this music, and my father also is a musician, so I'm coming from a musical family, he used to say once that Sevdah music will be sung after every war, you know? And it sounded so prophetic and so crazy at the time when he said that. But we lived to see another war in the 90s, and many people got interested in this music. I mean, the very song that we heard, O Bosanske Gore Snežne, was given to me as a present by a guy who's a former refugee, someone who had to flee Bosnia in the 90s. He lived in eastern Bosnia, so, as you know, genocide was committed against Bosniaks, Bosnian Muslims, and a lot of Bosniaks had to flee. Now he lives in Sweden, working in a police station, and he's a big fan of this music, and he learned it from his grandmother and his mother, and a couple of years back he gave it to me as a present, and I was really amazed with the beauty of this song, you know, how it's full of his own longing for his place of birth, you know, and this sad fact that he can never come back.
Singer Damir Imamović. This week, it was announced that the Hollywood actors Tom Hanks and his wife Rita Wilson have tested positive for the coronavirus. The problems facing the film industry may pale in comparison to the human toll taken by the disease, but in some parts of the world, the movie business is in dire straits. From deserted cinemas to the cancellation of major film events, the virus has been causing havoc, as Tom Brook reports from New York.
A clip from a Chinese film whose release in cinemas was derailed by the coronavirus outbreak. The Chinese movie industry has been especially hard hit by the coronavirus, with cinemas closed and production shut down. Gitesh Pandya follows international box office trends.
Well, for China, it's been devastating this year. They normally rely on the Lunar New Year for their biggest box office tally for the whole year, and that's exactly when theaters started to close. So you're looking at about $2 billion of box office sales wiped out in the first part of the year.
Hollywood is also in turmoil. A shoot of the latest Mission Impossible film has been shut down in Italy, and the launch of the new James Bond extravaganza has been postponed until November. Studio executives fear cinema admissions in North America may now begin to drop. The coronavirus is also changing what movie fans want to see. The 9-year-old sci-fi drama Contagion, depicting a global epidemic, has now become a top online choice. The film's plot uncannily matches what's been happening with the coronavirus.
On day one, there were 2 people, and then 4, and then 16. In 3 months, it's 1 billion. That's where we're headed.
Nigel Smith is news editor for movies at People magazine.
As soon as the virus started to spread in China, people started to stream this movie in really, really high numbers. It really foretold what we're experiencing today. It starts in Hong Kong, this fictional virus in the movie, and it spreads via the way that this current virus spreads, the touching of the face. So that's a little terrifying.
The biggest movie-related event cancelled so far in America has been South by Southwest, which would have brought thousands of people into Austin in Texas. Other festivals in peril include Cannes, due to get underway in May, and before that, the Tribeca Film Festival in New York City. Eric Cohn is executive editor at IndieWire.
Cannes prides itself as being the most important film festival in the world, certainly from a curatorial standpoint. You take that out and there's a real question of how do we assess the best movies of the year without the best film festival in the world.
The streaming giants at least are poised to do very well as movie fans stay at home to watch films instead of venturing into cinemas. China released 2 blockbusters online earlier this year after cinemas closed. Gitesh Pandya again.
This could be a big opportunity for streaming services. Obviously, they've grown a lot in the last year. Netflix, Amazon, Disney Plus is in the game as well. Hulu, there's YouTube. So many choices people have at home.
The global film industry is being rocked by the coronavirus. It seems almost certain that damage will continue to be done, and experts believe that it will take months, even years, for the movie business to recover.
Tom Brook in New York. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or anything in it, send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.